I invite you to take out your Bibles and turn to 1 Corinthians 16. It's good to see all of you today. And I see we got several that have been sick for a while, and now you're able to be with us and assemble with us. And I see we have some visitors too, so thankful that we have the people that we have here today and that we get the opportunity to worship God together. Hopefully by now you're in 1 Corinthians 16. Here's a passage probably a lot of us know. Verse 1, it says, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given orders to the churches of Galatia, so you must do also. On the first day of the week, let each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there would be no collections when I come. And when I come, whoever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem." Just stop there. What you see is here Paul writing to the Corinthians, basically asking them, "I don't know what to do with this. It's in my way." What you have here is in 1 Corinthians 16, you have the Apostle Paul that is writing to them saying, "Look, there's a famine in Jerusalem. There's needy saints that need to be taken care of. I need you on the first day of the week to lay something aside, store it up, so that the church at Corinth can be part of this good work. This good work to take care of the needy saints in Jerusalem." If we keep on reading on, we see that the Macedonian Christians or the Philippian Christians have already done this. And they're going to be traveling with me with their own people and their own gift. And when they get to Corinth, it's going to be embarrassing if y'all don't have any gift and y'all aren't going to be part of this work too. And so what I decided to talk about today is this concept in 1 Corinthians 16. The only two ways we see in the New Testament of the local church collecting money is here in 1 Corinthians 16 and in Acts chapter 4 when they laid their gift on the apostles' feet. And we'll read that passage and talk about that later. Of course, since we don't have any apostles today, 1 Corinthians 16 is the only way the apostles have given us to store up money. And thinking about laying by and store, there's a lot of Christians today that know that we're supposed to do this, but they have some questions about it. And maybe you've heard this before, and I'm going to try to address this morning. They ask the question, well, is this something we should actually be doing every first day of the week? Is this something that you truly, if you're a Christian, and you're a member of the Lord's church, and you have prospered, do you really have to lay by in store every day on the first day of the week? And what they ask is basically going, well, where's the need? You should only lay by in store if there's a need. And if there's not a need, well, then you shouldn't lay by in store. And when I approach that, the first thing I do is agree with that. You should only lay by in store if there's a need. And the way I'm going to answer this question, and I'm going to answer it at the very beginning, is there a need to lay by in store on the first day of the week? There will always be a need. And there has always been a need. And so when people ask to say, "Andrew, I only believe we should lay by in store and give according to our means on the first day of the week if there's a need," the quickest answer just to go back with is there's always a need. I mean, there's actually always been a need since the very beginning of the creation of the church in Acts 2 through Acts 4. And what are the needs that the church has to do? We think about this for a second. The church has to be the pillar and ground of the truth, don't we? This is what we've called to be. And look at 1 Timothy 3:14. 1 Timothy 3:14. Paul writes to Timothy in verse 14. After giving the qualifications of elders, he says, "These things I write to you, though I hope to come to you shortly. But if I am delayed, I write so that you may know ought to how to conduct yourself in the house of God, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and ground of the truth." And that works for the universal church and the local church. We go to Ephesians 4. What's our job there as well? It's to edify the saints, right? We're supposed to uphold the truth for our own people and to those all in the world. Do you know what that takes? How do we uphold the truth? Does that not take Bible study? Does that not take preaching? Does that not actually take having Bibles that we can read? And if we had someone that was studying with us, we could give them a Bible to read? What does all this take? It takes resources, doesn't it? It actually takes resources to uphold the truth. And we'll get into more specific examples later. How about this? The church has to praise God in Colossians 3:16. We're supposed to sing together the knowledge of Christ, sing psalms, hymns, spiritual songs, making melody in our heart to the Lord. Do you know what that takes? That takes resources. I mean, think about it for just a second. Does singing not take resources? We have to have a place where we can come together to sing. That's a resource. We have to have something to sing. We cannot just sing Amazing Grace every time because we all know that song. We have to have something in front of us so we can sing it together. It takes resources. What about this one? The church has to assemble. We have to do that. That isn't an option. In Hebrews 10:24, we've been commanded to do it. He tells us, let us stir up one another into good works, not forsaking the assembly as the manner of some, but exhorting and esteeming one another as you see the day approaching. We have to assemble. And what does that take? That takes resources. You have to have a place to assemble. Whether you're renting out the school of Tyrannus to assemble there, whether you're meeting at the temple to assemble there, or whether you're meeting in Philemon's house or meeting in a building like this, it takes a resource, doesn't it? And the reason why I start this off really early like this, I just want you to all understand, we don't live in a fairy tale land. What does Solomon say in Proverbs about money? He says, money answers everything. That's a bad word. We're like, well, hold on just a second. The Bible doesn't say that. But several times through the Proverbs and Ecclesiastes, he's like, look, wisdom is good, but you have to have money. Resources are important. And I think maybe what we've done is when we argue against this, what we've done is we've seen too many movies. And we've seen too many movies of like football teams winning national championships and having like this big, like exciting moment. But they're like, you know, we just did this on love and on, perseverance. No. Football teams win money. Football teams win games because somebody has money. Somebody has resources. Somebody can pay coaches to coach. Somebody can pay for them to have a field to practice on. Doing those things takes resources. Any good work we do takes resources. That's real life. If you're going to give to go help somebody, what is it? It takes a resource. If you're going to go cut a widow's grass, you have to own a lawnmower to cut their grass. You have to have gasoline to put in the lawnmower to cut their grass. I'm just trying to, at the very beginning here, get very, very realistic. You have to have resources to do good works, and that includes the work of the church. So is there a need? As long as the church is here on this earth, there will be a need to accomplish the work of the church. The way that we've studied this in the past, and I'm very appreciative of the way that we've studied this topic in the past. And what we'll do is we'll basically ask the question, you know, what can we spend the Lord's money on? We'll phrase it like that. Or maybe we'll say, you know, do we have authority to spend the Lord's money on this? And the way that we may have been taught is the big three, right? We can spend the Lord's money on benevolence to needy saints, to the work of edification, or the work of evangelism. That's a good way to learn it. And I'm not trying to contradict that at all. What I'm going to say is exactly the same thing. I'm just going to say it in a different way. The problem I have with these three is now I have to define what those three words are. And there's some of us in this room right now that don't have a clue what the word benevolence means. It just means taking care of those needy, especially needy saints in the Bible context. But what I want to say instead is have a general line to understand this. Instead of us asking the question, can we spend the Lord's money on this? We need to be asking the question, is this the work of the church? The church has to do the work of the church, right? And so if it's a work of the church that the church is doing, certainly can the church use its own resources to do that work? Absolutely it can. That's the point of the church having resources. It's so that the church can do the work of the church, and that takes resources. I've been coming to Jason all week and saying, Jason, I'm not going to say, can we spend the Lord's money on this? I'm going to say, is this the work of the church? That's the way we need to be teaching it, Jason. Jason, you'll tell me, Andrew, I know. Stop telling me. But this is the way that we're going to look at it this morning. What are the works of the church that we do that demands resources? What are the things that we actually need to do the work of the church? And so what we'll be looking at is the five times in the New Testament where resources were demanded, so that the church could do the work of the church. So we'll be looking at those examples in the New Testament. At the end, what we're going to do this morning is I want to talk about actually what here at Gardendale, the work that we are doing. And when we lay by in store on the first day of the week, these are the needs that we are meeting. Because we do have needs, and we do have a mission, and that mission takes resources. So let's look at these, and again, I'm going to keep it real simple and very literal. The first thing that we see in the New Testament is the supporting of the preaching of the gospel, right? And I've got these little bubbles here to try to help us kind of visualize what we're doing. You see a local church supporting a preacher to preach the gospel. And I got these verses up here on the screen. You can turn there if you like. Maybe some of us aren't good at turning, and I just wanted to have them up here. In Acts chapter 18, Paul comes for the first time to the church at Corinth, the one whom he wrote Corinthians to. And as he comes to the church of Corinth, he has to get a day job, you know? He has to get another job to support him so he can preach in this area. And that's how he meets Aquila and Priscilla. So Paul here came to them, Corinth, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and were working for by trade. They were tent makers. And he was reasoning in the synagogue every Sabbath to try to persuade the Jews and Greeks. Then the New American Standard reads it this way. But when Silas and Timothy came down from Macedonia, Paul began devoting himself completely to the word, solemnly testifying to the Jews that Jesus was the Christ. Why did he stop doing his tent-making job when Timothy and Silas came down from Macedonia and joined him in Corinth? Why could he now devote himself completely to the preaching and teaching of the gospel in Corinth? It's because the Macedonians sent him support, financial support. We get that by connecting this with 2 Corinthians chapter 11. 2 Corinthians chapter 11, now years later in the future, Paul is reminding the Corinthians about the first time he came to Corinth. And this is what he says. He says, "Or did I commit sin in humbling myself so that you might be exalted? Because I preached the gospel of God to you without charge. I robbed other churches by taking wages from them to serve you. And when I was present with you and was in need, I was not a burden to anyone. For when the brethren came from Macedonia, they fully supplied my need. And in everything, I kept myself from being a burden to you and will continue to do so." You see here, what are the brethren of Macedonia? Who are those people? Acts 18, that's Timothy and Silas. And they came and brought this gift that the Macedonians supported the preaching of Paul when he went to Corinth. And what did that take? That took resources, right? And they collected them and they gave them to Paul. But looking at 1 Corinthians 11, who else can the local church support preaching? Obviously here, the Macedonians are supporting a preacher abroad. But what was implied when he says to them, "I had to rob other churches to serve you"? What's implied is that the church at Corinth could have supported Paul while he was there. And so as a local church, we support the preachers that are abroad, but we also can support preachers that are here locally with us, right? Like me and Jason. And this is our job, and you financially support us to do that job so we can be part of that work of the church. So we see that in 1 Corinthians 11 as well. Number two, supporting preachers in distress, right? And the reason why I bring this one up is because this has happened in Birmingham. This has happened in Alabama. And you have brethren that get together and talk about it, and I don't think they're aware of this passage. Think about it for just a second. If there was a preacher that we supported, and all of a sudden he was in some type of serious trouble, whether it be his health, you know, maybe he's teaching the truth and he goes to prison, something awful's happened. Are we allowed to still support that preacher, even though he might be in prison, even though he might be very, very sick? The Bible gives us authority to do that. And what we do is we talk to each other, well, the preacher's not actually preaching anymore, so we can't support him anymore. And yet, this is the very thing that happened to the Apostle Paul when he writes the book of Philippians. Philippians is a thank you letter for the Philippians, the Macedonians, again giving support to the Apostle Paul while he's in distress, while he's in prison, waiting to be judged by the Caesar Nero. Philippians 4:14, Paul says, "Nevertheless, you have done well that you have shared in my distress, Now you, Philippians, know also that in the beginning of the gospel, when I departed from Macedonia, no church shared with me concerning giving and receiving, but you only. For even in Thessalonica sent aid once and again for my necessities. He tells the Philippians, you have been supporting me since day one. You know, and I love that about you, and I thank that about you. And now look, now you're sharing and supporting me in my distress. And so they collected a gift on the first day of the week, and they sent it by Epaphroditus to give it to Paul while he was in prison. And so what else can we do? We can support a preacher in distress, like we see in Philippians 4. Number three, we can financially support widows that meet the qualifications in 1 Timothy 5. Look at 1 Timothy 5 with me if you can, but I'm also going to have one of those verses up here on the screen. In 1 Timothy 5, the Apostle Paul gives qualifications for a widow to be taken into the number of the church. Of course, what's very important about 1 Timothy 5 is he does distinguish the difference between the work of the individual and the work of the church. And you see that in verse 4. 1 Timothy 5, verse 4, but if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show piety at home and to repay their parents, for this is good and acceptable before God. Now she who is really a widow and left alone trusts in God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day, but she who lives in pleasure is dead as she lives, and these things command that they may be blameless. But if anyone does not provide for his own, especially for those of his household, has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Do not let a widow under 60 years old, and then he gives the qualifications for taking a widow into the number, right? And so what you see what Paul says here is that if a widow needs to be supported, first and foremost, it's their children and their grandchildren's responsibility to take care of them. And if they refuse to take care of their widow, he's like, they're in huge trouble with God. You know, they're worse than an unbeliever. The child or the grandchild that does take care of their grandmother or their mother in their widow form, he says, this is well-pleasing to God. This is exactly what God expects. But he's like, if something goes wrong and the individual isn't meeting their responsibility, then it is the church's responsibility to gather their resources to take care of their widows that meet the qualifications that he gives here in 1 Timothy 5, right? We see here, especially as it builds up to verse 16, that he says, if any believing man or woman has widows, let them relieve them, and do not let the church be burdened that they may relieve those who are really widows. And it gives the concept here is that the church has priorities. And it's important that as individuals, we do our work the way we're supposed to do our work so the church can do its work to the fullest. This is a very important thing, and we learned a lot from this qualification here, right? And again, it's an exciting passage because you get to see that he says that these women have already labored for the Lord much. And now this is a way that we're sort of paying back those women through the work of the church because of the labor that they've done, right? What's the difference between a widow indeed and a needy saint? Hopefully you're like, Andrew, that's a good question. I think it is a good question. And let me give you one thought about that. When we see needy saints in the New Testament, that the work of the church is to take care of them, it's always because of like an emergency. Something has gone wrong. This isn't normal, right? And so the church steps in to keep that needy saint alive until that time has passed, right? And we see 2 Thessalonians 3 gives commands about that, that people did try to take advantage of that system. And the Apostle Paul shuts it down. What's different between the needy saint and the widow indeed? The widow indeed that meets the qualifications is going to be permanently supported by the church until A, their children, if they have any, finally repent and take up their responsibility, or B, she passes from this life. So this is like nothing has gone wrong. There's no emergency. This is just the reality. And so the church is to do that work. Well, let's talk about that next one in 1 Timothy 5. The next one here in 1 Timothy 5, you're there, is that the church can support elders if they devote themselves fully to the teaching of the word. You read that in that next passage. You can look there, look up here. Verse 17, the next verse. Let the elders who rule well be counted worthy of double honor, especially those who labor in word and doctrine. For the scripture says, you shall not muzzle an ox while it treads out the grain, and the laborer is worthy of his wages. In 1 Timothy 5:17 through 18. So if you have an elder that has devoted themselves to the teaching of the word and basically to be a full-time elder, their church can. And it is the work of the church to financially support that person as they do that work for the church. Can y'all imagine for just a second? And I know it gets taboo to talk about it. I mean, and I get up here and I talk about, you know, my salary. It gets taboo. I understand all that. But just imagine, take all that stuff out. Let's just look at the New Testament pattern. Can you imagine a local church that had 5, 4, 6 elders and they were all financially supported to be full-time elders? And they were writing Bible class material. And they were preaching a lot. And they were teaching Bible class. And they were visiting every day. And that was their job, was to be an elder, both for financial purposes and their spiritual purposes. Do you know how much work we could do? I think we could get a lot done. And this is something that we don't do anymore. At least I don't know of. I know there's some places where their preacher is also their elder, and I know that kind of fits sort of into this. But I think this is something that they probably were doing in the New Testament church, and a practice that we've kind of left. We don't have to leave it, though. We have authority to do it, don't we? We certainly see it here that a laborer is worthy of his wages. You can be paid for spiritual work, something Jesus taught, something Paul follows through with. Here's our last one. Needy saints, right? The work of the church is to take care of their local needy saints first. And we see that the very first time a collection is taken for the church. In Acts chapter 4, this is where we meet Barnabas. What we have here is several of these Jews have come for only 50 days from Passover to Pentecost. Jesus has died. They've joined the church 50 days later in Acts chapter 2. And now they want to stay with the apostles. But frankly, most of them there only have supplies for 50 days. But now they might be staying there for a year or two. So what do the disciples do in Jerusalem? Well, they sell what they have to make sure that everybody's eating and everybody has a place to sleep and everybody's taken care of. In Acts chapter 4, starting in verse 34, talking about the church, nor was there anyone among them who lacked, for all who were possessors of lands and houses sold them and brought those proceeds of things that were sold and laid them at the apostles' feet. And they distributed to each one as anyone had need. And Joseph, who was also named Barnabas by the apostles, which is translated the son of encouragement, a Levite in the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. And so you see this collection happening very early. And it was take care of their local needy saints. And so when something bad has happened, this is what the work of the church is. The work of the church is to make sure that you, as a member of Gardendale, that you survive. You know, if you didn't know already, we want you alive. We want you to be sure that you're eating at night, all right? We want to make sure that you survive this cruel world. And when bad things happen where you cannot have those necessities anymore, that is the work of the local church, that we make sure that you live. Right? And we make sure that you're able to get back to a place where you can meet your necessities, right? And ultimately become part of that giving process again. Well, that's local needy saints. But also, we've been given the authority to give to needy saints abroad through another local church. We see this very early on later. Paul is converted. And in Acts chapter 11, Paul and Barnabas are working at the church of Antioch. And Agabus the prophet comes and says there's going to be a famine in all of Judea. And so the church at Antioch decides to send a gift of support to take care of the needy saints by the way of Barnabas and Saul, who are going to give it to the elders there in Jerusalem. In verse 27 of Acts chapter 11, "And in those days, prophets came to Jerusalem to Antioch, and there was one of them named Agabus stood up among them and showed them by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world, which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, each according to his ability, determined to send relief to the brethren dwelling in Judea. This is also they did and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul." What you notice here, is this graph different than all the other graphs that we've seen? Every time we looked at any of these, I'll go back. It was like this. It was they're taking care of their own. Or, if I go back far enough, it was like this. There was a preacher somewhere else, and they gave to that preacher. They didn't give to the local church that he worked at and gave it to the preacher. They gave it directly to the preacher, right? This here is the only time in the New Testament where you see one local church gives to another local church so that local church can do its work. So this is what's talked about the most. We see it in Acts chapter 11. We see it in Acts 21. We see it in 1 Corinthians 16. We see it in 2 Corinthians 8, 9, and 10. And it is the exception. It is actually the only time you see a local church give to another local church to do a work. And why is it? You know, one is because, you know, God said it, and that's fine. Another reason is because it's an emergency. That local church, this local church, can no longer do its job. There's a famine. They have nothing. They are going to die. They are going to starve to death. And so this is the opportunity where God gives us an exception. And he says, yes, this local church should send to this local church so they can keep their members alive. This is what needs to happen. And God wrote a lot about this. We know all about this. Now, what would be wrong? No, we've made it very clear that this is the exception. What if the church that received the report said, wow, you know, we've got so much support. We got plenty of food. We don't really have any more needy saints. You know what? I want to be part of an evangelistic work. Let's use that money for evangelism. Well, now we've broken the pattern, haven't we? This was the exception. The exception was that we give that money to take care of those needy saints to get them back on their feet. There was never a place in the pattern for us to give to a local church so they could do another work of the local church. And that's why this is wrong, right? You think about recently when there was these hurricanes in Texas and everywhere. And a lot of local churches did give to the local churches in Texas because they were needy saints. They had members that lost their homes completely. They didn't have a place to live. Lots and lots of people lost their homes. And so we gave. Do you know what all those churches did after all their needy saints were taken care of? You remember, don't you? They sent that money back. Why did they send that money back? Because the one exception that God gave us, we fulfilled it. And it was completed. And they didn't have the right to keep that money and spend it on anything else but needy saints. Because that's why the money was given in the first place. And so this is the pattern that we're trying to match, aren't we? That we would only do this as the exception for needy saints abroad. We're going to cut the live stream now. Because we're going to get serious now. What I basically want to do now in this last part of the sermon